election, men who had been Confederate soldiers could not vote, but men who had been slaves could. In the former Confederacy, most white men who were able to vote were Democrats. 80% of eligible Republican voters were black men. Still, even with the protection of federal troops, black men were not always able to vote, especially as the Klan grew. Black men most often succeeded in casting ballots in the Upper South. 90% of black registered voters managed to vote in Virginia. In the Deeper South, black men arrived early at the polls and in groups, often marching together, by prearrangement, to protect themselves against attack. One election supervisor from Alabama described the first day of voting in 1867. "There must have been present near 1,000 freedmen, many as far as 30 miles from their home, all eager to vote." While the battle to ratify the 14th Amendment raged on, black men participated in more than Election Day. 800 black men served in state legislatures. They filled more than 1,000 public offices, mostly in town and county government. A black man was briefly governor of Louisiana. "Now is the black man's day. The whites have had their way long enough," said one politician. A northern journalist visiting the South Carolina legislature wrote, "The body is almost literally a black parliament. The speaker is black, the clerk is black, the doorkeepers are black, the little pages are black, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee is black, and the chaplain is coal black." Whites called it Negro rule. In Washington, Johnson struggled to regain his feet. Early in 1868, he tried to fire Secretary of War Edward Stanton, a radical Republican and Lincoln appointee. But Stanton, hard-headed and uncompromising, barricaded himself in his office for 2 months. The nation reeled from one constitutional crisis to the next. The House began impeachment proceedings against the president, charging him with violating a recently passed Tenure of Office Act. Congress voted to impeach 126-47, but the Senate vote, 35-19, fell one vote shy of the two-thirds required. Johnson had survived, but impeachment, a constitutional gun that had never before been fired, had for the first time been loaded. The 14th Amendment was finally ratified in the summer of 1868. That summer, Johnson failed to win the Democratic nomination for president, while Ohio-born Ulysses S. Grant, veteran of the war with Mexico and hero of the Civil War, won the Republican nomination, campaigning on the pledge, "Let us have peace." Black men who managed to vote despite the menace of the KKK nearly all voted for Grant. Women tried to vote, too. Before the 14th Amendment, women's rights reformers had fought for women's education and for laws granting to married women the right to control their own property. After the 14th Amendment, the women's rights movement became the women's suffrage movement, which both narrowed and intensified it. In 1868, in a plan that was known as the New Departure, black and white women attempted to gain their right to vote by exercising it. They went to the polls and were arrested when they tried to cast ballots. During those same years, it became increasingly difficult for black men to vote, leading Congress to debate and propose yet another constitutional amendment, one that would raise still more questions about citizens, persons, and people, categories whose limits had long been tested by women and were being newly tested by immigrants from China. Chinese immigrants began arriving in the United States in large numbers during the 1850s, following the gold rush. In 1849, California had 54 Chinese residents. By 1850, 791. By 1851, more than 7,000. By 1852, about 25,000. Most came from Guangzhou province and sailed from Hong Kong, sent by Chinese trading firms known as the Six Companies. Most were men. Landing in San Francisco, they worked as miners first in California and then in Oregon, Nevada, Washington, Idaho, Montana, and Colorado. In the federal census of 1860, 24,282 out of the 34,935 Chinese toiled in mines. Although some Chinese immigrants left mining and some were forced out, many continued to mine well into the 1880s, often working in sites abandoned by other miners. In 1867, a government report noted that in Montana, the digging now falls into the hands of the Chinese who patiently glean the fields abandoned by the whites. Chinese workers began settling in Boise in 1865, and only 5 years later constituted a third of Idaho's settlers and nearly 60% of its miners. In 1870, Chinese immigrants and their children made up nearly 9% of the population of California and one quarter of the state's wage earners. Their rights under state constitutions and statutes were markedly limited. Oregon's 1857 constitution barred Chinamen from owning real estate, while California barred Chinese immigrants from testifying in court, a provision upheld in an 1854 state Supreme Court opinion, People versus Hall, which described the Chinese as a race of people whom nature has marked as inferior and who are incapable of progress or intellectual development beyond a certain point, as their history has shown. The Chinese American population was growing at its fastest clip in the 1860s, just as the federal government was debating the relationship between citizenship and race. The 14th Amendment's provision for birthright citizenship, anyone born in the United States as a citizen, made no racial restriction. Under its terms, the children of Chinese immigrants born in the United States were American citizens. As Lyman Trumbull, a senator from Illinois, said during the debate over the amendment, "The child of an Asiatic is just as much a citizen as the child of a European." This interpretation of the amendment was upheld in an 1898 ruling by the Supreme Court in United States versus Wong Kim Ah. Trumbull, who'd helped write the 13th Amendment, was one of a very small number of men in Congress who talked about Chinese immigrants in favorable terms, describing them as citizens from that country which in many respects excels any other country on the face of the globe in the arts and sciences, among whose population are to be found the most learned and eminent scholars in the world. More typical was the view expressed by William Higbee, a Republican congressman from California and one-time miner. "The Chinese are nothing but a pagan race," Higbee said in 1866. "You cannot make good citizens of them." If the children of Chinese immigrants were U.S. citizens, what about the immigrants themselves? Chinese immigrants' most significant protection against discrimination in Western states was an 1868 treaty between China and the United States. It provided that Chinese subjects visiting or residing in the United States shall enjoy the same privileges, immunities, and exemptions in respect to travel or residence as may there be enjoyed by the citizen or subjects of the most favored nation. That treaty, though, didn't make Chinese immigrants into citizens. It only suggested that they be treated like citizens. And what about the voting rights of U.S.-born Chinese Americans? Much turned on the 15th Amendment, proposed early in 1869. While the aim of the amendment was to guarantee African Americans the right to vote and hold office, its language inevitably raised the question of Chinese citizenship and suffrage. Opponents of the amendment found its entire premise scandalous. Garrett Davis, a Democratic senator from Kentucky, fumed, "I want no Negro government. I want no Mongolian government. I want the government of the white man, which our fathers incorporated." Michigan's Jacob Howard urged that the 15th Amendment specifically bar Chinese men by introducing language explaining that the amendment only applied to the citizens of the United States of African descent. Presumably, Howard calculated that this revision, which amounted to Chinese exclusion, would improve the chances of the amendment's passage and ratification. But congressional enthusiasm for immigration thwarted his proposal. George F. Edmonds of Vermont called Howard's revision to the amendment an outrage, pointing out that this new language would enfranchise black men only by leaving out the native of every other country under the sun. Rare was the American orator who could devise out of a debate mired in invective an argument about citizenship that rested on human rights. But Frederick Douglass, at the height of his rhetorical powers, made just this argument in the speech in Boston in 1869. Who deserves citizenship and political equality? Not people of one descent or another or of one sex or another, but all people, Douglass insisted. "The Chinese will come," he said. "Do you ask if I favor such immigration? I answer, I would. Would you have them naturalized and have them invested with all the rights of American citizenship? I would. Would you allow them to vote? I would." Douglass spoke about what he called a composite nation, a strikingly original and generative idea, about a citizenry made better and stronger, not in spite of its many elements, but because of them. "I want a home here, not only for the Negro, the mulatto, and the Latin races, but I want the Asiatic to find a home here in the United States and feel at home here, both for his sake and for ours." Douglass's expansiveness, his deep belief in equality, did not prevail. In its final language, the 15th Amendment, ratified in 1870, declared that the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. It neither settled nor addressed the question of whether Chinese immigrants could become citizens, and in practice it hardly settled what it proposed to settle, the voting rights of black men, for whom voting became only more difficult and more dangerous in the face of a rising tide of terrorism. even though a Republican-controlled Congress passed the Force Act of 1870 and the Klan Act of 1871, making it illegal to restrict or interfere with suffrage, the Klan only increased its efforts to take back the South, rampaging across the land. Nor did the 15th Amendment settle the question of whether women could vote. On the one hand, it didn't guarantee women that right, since it didn't bar discrimination by sex, only discrimination by race, color, or previous condition of servitude. On the other hand, it didn't suggest that women couldn't vote. What it did do was to divide the equal rights movement, splitting the American Equal Rights Association, a civil rights organization, into two. Stanton and Anthony founding the National Woman Suffrage Association, which did not support the amendment, and the veteran reformer Lucy Stone and the poet Julia Ward Howe founding the rival American Woman Suffrage Association, which did. The rift would be mended when the two organizations merged in 1890 as the National American Woman Suffrage Association. In 1870, five black women were arrested for voting in South Carolina. But by now, women had decided to test the limits of female citizenship, not only by voting, but also by running for office. Victoria Woodhull, a charismatic fortune teller from Ohio who'd attended a suffrage convention in 1869, moved to New York and reinvented herself as a stockbroker, became the first woman to run for president. She ran as a self-nominated candidate of the party she helped create, the Equal Rights Party. In 1871, she announced, "We are plotting revolution." Woodhull said she ran mainly for the purpose of drawing attention to the claims of women to political equality with men. Ingeniously, she argued that women already had the right to vote under the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the Constitution, an argument she brought before a House Judiciary Committee, making her the first woman to address a congressional committee. "As I have been the first to comprehend these constitutional and legal facts, so am I the first to proclaim, as I now do proclaim, to the women of the United States of America, that they are enfranchised." Woodhull's candidacy ended in ignominy. She spent Election Day in prison on charges of obscenity, and in the end, the Supreme Court ruled against her interpretation of the Constitution, deciding in Minor versus Happersett that the Constitution did not automatically confer the right to vote on those who were citizens. Woodhull's adventurous, glamorous, and shocking campaign helped ensure that the question commanded attention, even if that attention was at best polite. "The honest demand of any class of citizens for additional rights should be treated with respectful consideration," Republicans announced at their 1872 convention, a position that Stanton called not a plank but a splinter. At the party's 1876 convention, marking the centennial of the Declaration of Independence, Sarah Spencer of the National Woman Suffrage Association said, "In this bright new century, let me ask you to win to your side the women of the United States." She was hissed. At that same convention, Frederick Douglass, his raven hair now streaked with gray, became the first black person to speak before any nominating convention. Spencer had pleaded, Douglass pressed. "The question now is," he said, eyeing the crowd of rowdy delegates silenced by his booming voice, "do you mean to make good to us the promises in your Constitution?" Their answer apparently was no. That fateful year, a century after the nation was founded, Reconstruction failed, felled by the seedy compromises, underhanded dealings, personal viciousness, and outright fraud of small-minded and self-gratifying men. Grant, dissuaded from running for a third term, stepped down in 1876. Roscoe Conkling, a big, bearded boxer and New York senator, was so sure he'd get the party's nomination that he picked his vice president and a motto, "Conkling and Hayes is the ticket that pays," only to be defeated by his erstwhile running mate, the lackluster former governor of Ohio, Rutherford B. Hayes. When the Democrats met in St. Louis, the first time a convention was held west of the Mississippi, a delegation opposed to the nomination of the New York governor and dogged reformer Samuel Tilden hung a giant banner from the balcony of the Lindell Hotel. It read, "The city of New York, the largest Democratic city in the Union, uncompromisingly opposed to the nomination of Samuel J. Tilden for the presidency because he cannot carry the state of New York." Tilden won the nomination anyway, and in the general election, he won the popular vote against Hayes. Unwilling to accept the result of the election, Republicans disputed the returns in Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina. Eventually, the decision was thrown to an electoral commission that brokered a nefarious compromise. Democrats agreed to throw their support behind the man ever after known as Rutherford B. Hayes so that he could become president in exchange for a promise from Republicans to end the military occupation of the South. For a minor and petty political win over the Democratic Party, Republicans first committed electoral fraud, and then, in brokering a compromise, abandoned a century-long fight for civil rights. Political equality had been possible in the South only at the barrel of a gun. As soon as federal troops withdrew, white Democrats calling themselves the Redeemers took control of state governments of the South, and the era of black men's enfranchisement came to a violent and terrible end. The Klan terrorized the countryside, burning houses and hunting, torturing, and killing people. Between 1882 and 1930, murderers lynched more than 3,000 black men and women. Black politicians elected to office were thrown out, and all white legislatures began passing a new set of black codes, known as Jim Crow laws, that segregated blacks from whites in every conceivable public place, down to the last street corner. Tennessee passed the first Jim Crow law in 1881, mandating the separation of blacks and whites in railroad cars. Georgia became the first state to demand separate seating for whites and blacks in streetcars in 1891. Courthouses provided separate Bibles, bars provided separate stools, post offices mandated separate windows, playgrounds had separate swings. In Birmingham, for a black child to play checkers with a white child in a public park became a crime. Slavery had ended. Segregation had only begun. 2. Mary E. Leese crossed the plains like a tornado. "Raise less corn and more hell," she said. She could talk for hours, her audience rapt. She stood almost 6 feet tall. "Tall and raw-boned and ugly as a mud hen," one reporter called her. "The People Party's Amazon," said another. A writer who watched her said she had a golden voice, an extraordinary contralto. To listen to her was to be hypnotized. A founder and principal orator of the populist movement, Leese believed that after the Civil War, the federal government had conspired with corporations and bankers to wrest political power from ordinary people, like farmers and factory workers. "There is something radically wrong in the affairs of this nation," Leese told a mesmerized crowd in 1891. "We have reached a crisis in the affairs of this nation, which is of more importance, more fraught with mighty consequence for the weal or woe of the American people, than was even that crisis that engaged the attention of the people of this nation in the dark and bleeding years of civil strife." Leese had known that civil strife in her heart and by her hearth. Born in 1850, the daughter of Irish immigrants, she'd lost her father, two brothers, and an uncle in the Civil War. Her uncle died at Gettysburg, and her father starved to death as a prisoner of war. She never forgave the South or the Democratic Party, which she called all her life the intolerant, vindictive, slave-making Democratic Party. Married in 1873, she raised four children and lost two more to early death while farming in Kansas and Texas and taking in washing and also writing and studying law. What was this new crisis endangering the nation that she talked about in hundreds of speeches to applause as loud as a torrent of rain hitting the roof of a barn? "Capital buys and sells today the very heartbeats of humanity," she said. Democracy itself had been corrupted by it. "The speculators, the land robbers, the pirates and gamblers of this nation have knocked unceasingly at the doors of Congress, and Congress has in every case acceded to their demands." "The capitalists," she said, "had subverted the will of the people." The populist movement, marble in the flesh of American politics into the 21st century, started in the South and in the West. Leese and people like her drew on the agrarian republicanism of Thomas Jefferson and the common man rhetoric of Andrew Jackson, but they also influenced the political commitments of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, serving as a bridge between populism and progressivism, the two great political reform movements that straddled the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. Leese fought for the farmers and wage laborers whose political voices, she believed, were being shouted down by capitalists. But she also fought for women's suffrage and for temperance and helped to diffuse a distinctive female political style, the moral crusade, throughout American politics. Prevented from entering the electorate, women who wanted to influence public affairs relied on forms of popular politics that among men were on the decline. The march, the rally, the parade. In the late 19th century, a curious reversal took place. Electoral politics, the politics men engaged in, became domesticated. The office work of education and advertising, even voting, moved indoors. Meanwhile, women's political expression moved to the streets. And there, at marches, rallies, and parades, women deployed the tools of the 19th century religious revival. the sermon, the appeal, the conversion. The female political style left its traces in every part of American politics, nowhere more deeply than in the populist tradition. Beginning in the 20th century, it would drive the modern conservative movement. What Lee's described as a conspiracy between the federal government and capitalists, especially railroad company owners and bankers, had its roots in the Civil War itself, and in the federal government's shifting policy toward the West. Before the war, the controversy over slavery had limited federal involvement in the West. But when the South seceded, Democratic opposition in Congress disappeared, giving Republicans a free hand. Without Democrats fighting for slavery's expansion, Republicans had made haste to bring the West into the Union and to exert authority over its economic development. A Republican Congress had approved the organization of new territories, the Dakotas, 1861, Nevada, 1861, Arizona, 1863, Idaho, 1863, and Montana, 1864. In 1862 alone, in addition to the Homestead Act, the Republican Congress had passed the Pacific Railway Act, chartering railroad companies to build a line from Omaha, Nebraska to Sacramento, California, and the National Bank Act to issue paper money to pay for it all. After the war, political power moved from the states to the federal government, and as the political influence of the South waned, the importance of the West rose. Congress not only sent to the states amendments to the Constitution that defined citizenship and guaranteed voting rights, but also passed landmark legislation involving the management of Western land, the control of native populations, the growth and development of large corporations, and the construction of a national transportation infrastructure. The independent farmer, the lingering ideal of the Jeffersonian yeoman, remained the watchword of the West, but in truth, the family farming for subsistence free of government interference was far less common than a federally subsidized capitalist model of farming and cattle raising for a national or even an international market. The small family farm, Jefferson's Republican dream, was in many parts of the arid West an environmental impossibility. Much of the property distributed under the terms of the Homestead Act, primarily in the Great Basin, was semi-arid, the kind of land on which few farmers could manage a productive farm with only 160 acres. Instead, Congress typically granted the best land to railroads and allowed other bigger interests to step in, buying up large swaths for agricultural business or stock raising and fencing it in, especially after the patenting of barbed wire in 1874. With the overwhelming force of the U.S. Army, the federal government opened land for settlement by suppressing Indian insurrections, including a rebellion of more than 6,000 Dakota Sioux. In measures that began as exigencies of war, the federal government forced Native peoples off their land while providing corporations with incentives to build railroads. In a single 10-year span, Congress granted more than 100 million acres of public lands to railroad companies. In 1870, only 2 million non-Indians lived west of the Missouri River. By 1890, that number had risen to more than 10 million. As railroads owned by large corporations extended their tentacles like so many octopuses across the vast lands owned by giant companies, the big business of beef cattle raising grew. Railroads made it possible to carry massive herds to markets in cities like Chicago, St. Louis, Omaha, and Kansas City. Buffalo that had long thrived on those lands were slaughtered nearly to extinction and replaced by Texas longhorns, 5 million of which were driven to railroad terminals in 1865 by cowboys of all backgrounds, white, black, Mexican, and Indian. By 1880, 2 million cattle were slaughtered in Chicago alone. In 1885, an American economist tried to reckon the extraordinary transformation wrought by what was now 200,000 miles of railroad, more than in all of Europe. It was possible to move 1 ton of freight 1 mile for less than 0.7 cents, a sum so small, he wrote, that outside of China it would be difficult to find a coin of equivalent value to give a boy as a reward for carrying an ounce package across the street. The transformation of the West fueled the American economy, but it also produced instability, especially given rampant land speculation and the popularity of railroad stocks and bonds, novel financial instruments issued and managed by the federal government. That instability contributed to a broader set of political concerns that became Mary Leese's obsession, concerns known as the money question, and traceable all the way back to Hamilton's economic plan. Should the federal government control banking and industry? Federal land and railroad projects required vast amounts of spending at a time when Americans were uncertain how to pay their debts. Like the continental currency printed during the Revolutionary War, greenbacks issued during the Civil War and not backed up by gold soon became all but valueless. After the war, Goldbugs argued for a collection and retirement of the greenbacks and the establishment of the gold standard. Silverites supported a standard of specie-backed currency, but not specifically gold. In 1869, Congress passed the Public Credit Act, promising to pay back its own debt in specie or specie-backed notes. But with all its borrowing and intricate financial instruments, the federal government, especially the administration of Ulysses S. Grant, became notorious for corruption and bribery. Matters reached a crisis point in 1873 for Mary Leese, and for the country, too. That spring, Leese and her husband and children moved to Kingman, Kansas, onto land they'd acquired through the Homestead Act. The Leeses got their Kansas land for free, but Mary's husband Charles had to borrow hefty sums of money from a local bank to buy tools and pay land office fees. They lived in a sod house where Mary pinned newspaper pages to the walls so that she could read while kneading dough. For a few months, they scraped by, but within a year, they were unable to repay their debts, and the bank repossessed their land. Life on a Kansas farm was like trying to raise corn on a beach of sand. Better to raise hell. In suffering financial ruin in the dire year of 1873, the Leeses were not alone. 1873 saw the worst financial disaster since the Panic of 1837. Blame for the collapse rests on the desk of a white-whiskered Philadelphia banker named Jay Cook, the latest in a long line of scoundrels that went all the way back to William Dewar, whose swindling brought on the Panic of 1792. Cook had made a great deal of money during the Civil War, investing in federal war bonds and in the Northern Pacific Railway, chartered by Congress in 1864. His brother Henry had been placed in charge of the Freedmen's Savings Bank, chartered in 1865. Henry Cook illegally invested the bank's money, the savings of freedmen, in his brother's railroad ventures. The proposed Northern Pacific was supposed to go through lands owned and occupied by the Sioux, who in 1872 began fighting against the U.S. Army. Investors pulled out of Jay Cook's scheme, and Henry Cook Savings Bank collapsed. Jay Cook and Company closed and declared bankruptcy, a bankruptcy that led to a nationwide depression. More than 100 banks and nearly 20,000 businesses failed. Even after the worst of the depression was over, the price of grain kept on falling. A farmer's profit on a bushel of corn had been 45 cents in 1870. By 1889, the profit on that same bushel had fallen to 10 cents. The populist revolt began when farmers started banding together and calling for cooperative farming and regulation of banks and railroads and an end to corporate monopolies. Nearly a million small farmers in the South and the Midwest flocked to an organization called the Grange. On July 4, 1873, they issued a Farmer's Declaration of Independence, calling for an end to the tyranny of monopoly, which they described as the absolute despotism of combinations that under the fostering care of government and with wealth wrung from the people, have grown to such gigantic proportions as to overshadow all the land and wield an almost irresistible influence for their own selfish purposes in all its halls of legislation. Finance capitalism had brought tremendous gains to investors and generated vast fortunes, inaugurating the era known as the Golden Age, edged with gold. It spurred economic development, and especially the growth of big businesses, big railroad companies, big agriculture companies, and beginning in the 1870s, big steel companies. Andrew Carnegie built his first steel mill in 1875. But to poor farmers like Mary Leese, and to the farmers who joined the Grange, finance capitalism looked like nothing so much, as Leese put it, as a fraud against the people. It looked that way to wage laborers, too. The Knights of Labor, founded in 1869 and with 700,000 members by the 1880s, crusaded against the kings of industry. 100 years ago, we had one king of limited powers, the head of the Knights of Labor said. Now we have 100 kings, uncrowned ones, it is true, but monarchs of unlimited power, for they rule through the wealth they possess. The laborers who raised their fists against the new uncrowned kings also hoped to crush beneath their feet the new peasants. No group of native-born Americans was more determined to end Chinese immigration than factory workers. The 1876 platform of the Workingmen's Party of California declared that to an American, death is preferable to life on par with a Chinaman. In 1882, spurred by the nativism of populists, Congress passed its first ever immigration law, the Chinese Exclusion Act, which barred immigrants from China from entering the United States, and determining that the 14th Amendment did not apply to people of Chinese ancestry, decreed that Chinese people already in the United States were permanent aliens who could never become citizens. The National Farmers Alliance, formed in Texas in 1877 to fight for taxing of railroads and corporations and for the establishment of farm cooperatives and the removal of fences from public lands, soon spread into the Dakotas, Nebraska, Minnesota, Iowa, and Kansas. Populists, whether farmers or factory workers, for all the invocation of the people, tended to take a narrow view of citizenship. United in their opposition to the money power, members of the alliance, like members of the Knights of Labor, were also nearly united in their opposition to the political claims of Chinese immigrants and of black people. The Farmers Alliance excluded African Americans, who formed their own association, the Colored Farmers Alliance. Nor did populists count Native Americans within the body of the people. The long anguish of dispossession and slaughter that had begun in Haiti in 1492 opened a new chapter in the 1880s on the eve of the 400th anniversary of Columbus's first voyage. Since the era of Andrew Jackson and the forced removal of the Cherokees from their homelands, the federal government's Indian policy rested on treaties that confined Native peoples to reservations, domestic dependent nations. This policy had led to decades of suffering, massacre, and war, as many people, especially on the plains where the Cheyenne and the Sioux stood their ground, had resisted forced confinement. Plains warfare ended in 1886 when Geronimo of the Badancu Band of the Chiricahua Apaches became one of the last Native leaders to surrender to the U.S. Army. And still, the conquest continued. In 1887, Congress passed the Dawes Severalty Act, under whose terms the U.S. government offered Native peoples a path to citizenship in a nation whose reach had extended across the lands of their ancestors. The Dawes Act granted to the federal government the authority to divide Indian lands into allotments and guaranteed U.S. citizenship to Indians who agreed to live on those allotments and renounce tribal membership. In proposing the allotment plan, Massachusetts Senator Henry Lawrence Dawes argued that the time had come for Indians to choose between extermination or civilization, and insisted that the law offered Americans the opportunity to wipe out the disgrace of our past treatment and instead lift Indians up into citizenship and manhood. But in truth, the Dawes Act understood Native peoples neither as citizens nor as persons of color, and led to nothing so much as forced assimilation and the continued takeover of Native lands. In 1887, Indians held 138 million acres. By 1900, they held only half of that territory. From the great debate at Valladolid in 1550 between Las Casas and Sepúlveda, debate about the morality of conquest had continued all but unabated across hundreds of years, during which each generation of Europeans and Americans who had confronted what by the middle of the 19th century they called the Indian problem had fallen short of their own understanding of justice. Populist grievances were many and bitter. Their best-founded objection was their concern about the federal government's support of the interests of businesses against those of labor. This applied in particular to railroads. In 1877, railroad workers protesting wage cuts went on strike in cities across the country. President Hayes sent in federal troops to end the strikes, marking the first use of the power of the federal government to support business against labor. The strikes continued with little success in improving working conditions. Between 1881 and 1894, there was on average one major railroad strike a week. Labor was generally and literally crushed. In a single year, of some 700,000 men working on the railroads, more than 20,000 were injured on the job and nearly 2,000 killed. The lasting legacy of this battle came in the courts. When state legislatures tried to tax the railroads, as California did, federal judges eagerly entertained arguments that such taxes were unconstitutional, even going so far as accepting the argument that such laws violated the rights of corporations as persons. In 1882, Roscoe Conkling represented the Southern Pacific Railroad Company's challenge to a California tax rule. He told the U.S. Supreme Court, "I come now to say that the Southern Pacific Railroad Company and its creditors and stockholders are among the persons protected by the 14th Amendment." Conkling, aside from having been a senator and a presidential candidate, had twice been nominated to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. He declined, unwilling to bear the loss of his income as a corporate attorney. In offering an argument about the meaning and original intention of the word person in the 14th Amendment, Conkling enjoyed a singular authority. He'd served on the Joint Committee on Reconstruction that had drafted the amendment, and by 1882 was the lone member of that committee still living. With no one alive to contradict him, Conkling assured the court that the committee had specifically rejected the word citizen in favor of person in order to include corporations. A legal fiction that corporations are artificial persons dates to the 18th century. It's true that the rights and wrongs of freedmen were the chief spur and incentive of the amendment, Conkling allowed, but corporations had been on the minds of its drafters too. A New York newspaper, reporting on that day's oral arguments, headlined its story, "Civil Rights of Corporations." Much evidence suggests, however, that Conkling was lying. The record of the deliberations of the Joint Committee on Reconstruction does not support his argument regarding the committee's original intentions, nor is it plausible that between 1866 and 1882, the framers of the 14th Amendment had kept mysteriously hidden their secret intention to guarantee equal protection and due process to corporations. But in 1886, when another railroad case, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, reached the Supreme Court, the court's official recorder implied that the court had accepted the doctrine that corporations are persons within the meaning of the 14th Amendment. After that, the 14th Amendment, written and ratified to guarantee freed slaves equal protection and due process of law, became the chief means by which corporations freed themselves from government regulation. In 1937, Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black would observe, with grim dismay, that over the course of 50 years, only 0.5% of the 14th Amendment cases that came before the court had anything to do with African Americans or former slaves, while over half of the cases were about protecting the rights of corporations. Rights guaranteed to the people were proffered, instead, to corporations. 3. "Man is man," Mary E. Leese liked to say, "but woman is Superman." Populism gave vent to the grievances of farmers and laborers against businesses and government. But the movement was built by women, women who believed that they were morally superior to men. Leese entered politics by way of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, the WCTU, a federation of women's clubs formed in Cleveland in 1874, in itself an outgrowth of a campaign against saloons known as the Woman's Crusade. She first spoke in public at a WCTU rally in Kansas, delivering a hair-raiser called "A Plea for the Temperance Ballot for Women." Leese argued that to end the scourge of alcohol, which for women served as shorthand for husbands who beat their wives and children and who spent their wages on drinking, leaving their families to starve, women needed the right to vote. This argument reshaped the nation's political parties. In 1872, the Prohibition Party became the first party to declare itself in favor of women's suffrage. 7 years later, the WCTU, under the leadership of Frances Willard, adopted "Home Protection" as its motto. The indefatigable Willard, who'd been president of a women's college and the first female dean of Northwestern University, lived by another motto, "Do everything." When the Republican Party failed to support either prohibition or suffrage, Willard defected from the GOP and founded the Home Protection Party, which in 1882 merged with the Prohibition Party. "Then and there," Willard wrote, "American women entered politics, and when they came to stay." Like Leese, Sarah E. V. Emery, a devout Universalist from Michigan, rose to prominence as a speaker and writer through the WCTU, the Knights of Labor, and the Farmers Alliance. The Farmers Alliance sold over 400,000 copies of Emery's anti-Semitic tract, "Seven Financial Conspiracies Which Have Enslaved the American People." "It is within the memory of many of my readers when millionaires were not indigenous to American soil," Emery wrote. "But that period has passed, and today we boast more millionaires than any other country on the globe. Tramps have increased in geometrical ratio, while strikes, riots, and anarchist trials constitute an exciting topic of conversation in all classes of society." Emery blamed this state of affairs on a conspiracy of Jewish bankers. To advance their causes, both populists and suffragists, rejecting the major parties, turned to third-party politics. If the Republican Party had turned its back on equal rights for women, the Democratic Party had still less an interest in the cause. Susan B. Anthony hoped to deliver a speech at the 1880 Democratic National Convention, calling on the party to secure to 20 millions of women the rights of citizenship. Instead, Anthony was left to look on in silence while her statement was read by a male clerk, after which, the New York Times reported, No action whatever was taken in regard to it, and Miss Anthony vexed the convention no more. Marietta Stowe, a newspaper publisher, declared that it was quite time that we had our own party, and ran for governor of California in 1882 as a candidate of the Woman's Independent Political Party. 2 years later, Belva Lockwood, a D.C. attorney, campaigned as the presidential candidate of the Equal Rights Party. In 1886, Emory spoke on behalf of suffrage planks at both the Democratic Party and Prohibition Party conventions. But Judith Ellen Foster, who'd helped found the WCTU, condemned third parties at a Republican rally. Far from honoring woman, a third party only appropriates her work and her influence to its own purposes, Foster warned. In 1892, Foster founded the Women's National Republican Association. "We are here to help you," she told the party's male delegates at its convention that year. And, she added, echoing Willard, "we've come to stay." By then, Lise had helped found not a women's club or a women's party, but a people's party, which joined with a movement led by a California newspaper man named Henry George. A character straight out of a Melville novel, George, born in Philadelphia in 1839, had left school at 14 and sailed to India and Australia as a foremast boy on board a ship called the Hindu. Romantics wrote about India as a place of jewels and jasmine. George was struck, instead, by its poverty. Returning to Philadelphia, he became a printer's apprentice, a position that many radicals before him had taken into politics. Benjamin Franklin had been a printer's apprentice. So had William Lloyd Garrison. Enticed by the West, he joined the crew of a Navy lighthouse ship sailing around Cape Horn in 1858 because it was the only way he could afford to get to California. In San Francisco, he edited a newspaper. It soon failed. By 1865, married and with four children, he was begging on the streets to feed his family. He finally found work, first as a printer and then as a writer and editor, with the San Francisco Times. From the West, when the railroad had nearly crossed the continent, George wrote an essay called "What the Railroads Will Bring Us." His answer, "The rich will get richer and the poor will get poorer." In a 4th of July oration in 1877, he declared, "No nation can be freer than its most oppressed, richer than its poorest, wiser than its most ignorant." In Progress and Poverty, an inquiry into the causes of industrial depression and of increase of want with increase of wealth, published in 1879, George argued that the very same technological progress that had brought so many marvels brought wealth to the few and poverty to the many. Discovery upon discovery and invention after invention have neither lessened the toil of those who most need respite nor brought plenty to the poor, he wrote. He devised an economic plan that involved abolishing taxes on labor and instead imposing a single tax on land. Tocqueville had argued that democracy in America is made possible by economic equality. People with equal estates will eventually fight for and win equal political rights. George agreed. But like Mary Leese, he thought that financial capitalism was destroying democracy by making economic equality impossible. He saw himself as defending the republicanism of Jefferson and the democracy of Jackson. George believed that the problem of inequality could not be solved without reforming elections. Suffragists suggested that the solution to corrupt elections was for women to vote, and some suggested it would be better to retract the franchise from poor white men and give it to wealthy white women instead. But George, while granting that elections had become a national scandal, resisted the conclusion that democracy is therefore condemned or that universal suffrage must be abandoned. He didn't want poor white men to lose the right to vote, and he supported women's suffrage, though he vehemently opposed extending either suffrage or any other right of citizenship to Chinese immigrants or their children. He wanted white men to vote better. In the age of popular politics, Election Day was a day of drinking and brawls. Party thugs stationed themselves at the polls and bought votes by doling out cash called soap and handing voters pre-printed party tickets. Buying votes cost anything from $2.50 in San Francisco to $20 in Connecticut. In Indiana, men sold their suffrages for no more than the cost of a sandwich. Prohibitionists argued that the best way to battle corruption was to get alcohol out of elections. George argued for getting money out. In 1871, after the New York Times began publishing the results of an investigation into the gross corruption of elections in New York City under Democratic Party boss William Magair Tweed, George, who had spent considerable time in Australia and had married an Australian woman, proposed a reform that had been introduced in Australia in 1856. Under the terms of Australia's ballot law, No campaigning could take place within a certain distance of the polls, and election officials were required to print ballots and either to build booths or hire rooms to be divided into compartments where voters could mark their ballots in secret. Without such reforms, George wrote, we might almost think soberly of the propriety of putting up our offices at auction. To promote the Australian ballot, George created a new party, the Union Labor Party. Mary Leese joined the party in Kansas. In 1886, George, having moved east, ran for mayor of New York on the Union Labor ticket. The Democratic candidate, Abraham Hewitt, won, but George beat the Republican, 28-year-old Theodore Roosevelt, a young man who, only 6 years before, had written a senior thesis at Harvard titled The Practicability of Equalizing Men and Women Before the Law. 3 years later, Henry George and Mary Leese helped to form the People's Party. We are depending upon the votes of freemen for our success, votes of men who will not be bought or sold, Leese said at the party's Kansas convention in 1890. Let our motto be more money and less misery. As the suffering of farmers and wage workers grew, so did the ranks of the People's Party, which became the most successful third party in American history. Between 1889 and 1893, the mortgages on so many farms were foreclosed that 90% of farmland fell into the hands of bankers. The richest 1% of Americans owned 51% of the nation's wealth, and the poorest 44% owned less than 2%. Populists didn't oppose capitalism. They opposed monopolism, which Leese called the divine right of capital, predicting that it would go the way of the divine right of kings. If they weren't quite socialists, they were certainly collectivists. Henry George is not the representative of any political party, clan, or ism, Leese said. In the great struggle now going on between the millions who have not enough to eat and the plutocratic few who have a million times more than their craven bodies deserve, in the great struggle between human greed and human freedom, Henry George stands as a fearless exponent and defender of human rights. For all its passionate embrace of political equality and human rights and its energetic championing of suffrage, the People's Party rested on a deep and abiding commitment to exclude from full citizenship anyone from or descended from anyone from Africa or Asia. Emory's anti-Semitism pervaded the movement as well, but it did not attach itself to arguments about citizenship. Populism's racism and nativism rank among its longest-lasting legacies. Leese, in a wildly incoherent white supremacist screed called The Problem of Civilization Solved, wove together the population theories of Thomas Malthus and Thomas Jefferson with the colonization schemes endorsed by James Madison and the outright racism of the social Darwinist Herbert Spencer to propose that all manual labor be done by Africans and Asians. Through all the vicissitudes of time, the Caucasian has arisen to the moral and intellectual supremacy of the world, she wrote. And the time had come for white people to realize their destiny to become the guardians of the inferior races. Many of the reforms proposed by populists had the effect of diminishing the political power of blacks and immigrants. Chief among them was the Australian ballot, more usually known as the secret ballot, which, by serving as a de facto literacy test, disenfranchised both black men in the rural South and new immigrants in northern cities. In 1888, the Kentucky State Legislature became the first in the nation to attempt the reform in the city of Louisville. The election last Tuesday was the first municipal election I've ever known which was not bought outright, one observer wrote to the nation after Election Day. Massachusetts passed a secret ballot law later that year. The measure seemed likely to suppress the Democratic vote, since literacy was lowest among the newest immigrants to northern cities who tended to vote Democratic. In New York, the Democratic governor, David Hill, vetoed a secret ballot bill 3 times. Hill's veto was only broken in 1890 after 14 men carried a petition weighing 0.5 ton to the floor of the New York legislature. Massachusetts and New York proved the only states to deliberate at length over the secret ballot. Quickest to adopt the reform were the states of the former Confederacy, where the reform appealed to legislatures eager to find legal ways to keep black men from voting. In 1890, Mississippi held a constitutional convention and adopted a new state constitution that included an understanding clause. Voters were required to pass oral examination on the Constitution on the grounds that very few Negroes understood the clauses of the Constitution. Nor, of course, did most whites, though white men were not tested. In the South, the secret ballot was adopted in this same spirit. Both by law and by brute force, Southern legislators, state by state, and poll workers, precinct by precinct, denied black men the right to vote. In Louisiana, black voter registration dropped from 130,000 in 1898 to 5,300 in 1908 to 730 in 1910. In 1893, Arkansas Democrats celebrated their electoral advantage by singing, "The Australian ballot works like a charm. It makes them think and scratch. And when a Negro gets a ballot, he has certainly met his match." Populists' other signal reform was the graduated income tax, a measure they believed essential to the survival of a democracy undermined by economic inequality. After the Civil War, a wartime federal income tax had been allowed to expire over the protests of John Sherman, a Republican from Ohio who would go on to author the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, and who, countering Jefferson, pointed out that tariffs unfairly burdened the poor. "We tax the tea, the coffee, the sugar, the spices the poor man uses," Sherman said. "Everything that he consumes we call a luxury and tax it. Yet we are afraid to touch the income of Mr. Astor. Is there any justice in that? Is there any propriety in it? Why, sir, the income tax is the only one that tends to equalize these burdens between rich and poor." But the man who drove this point home was the inimitable William Jennings Bryan. Tall, broad-shouldered, and sturdy in a string tie and cowhide boots, Bryan carried populism from the plains to the Potomac and turned the Democratic Party into the People's Party. Born in Illinois in 1860, he'd snuck into the Democratic National Convention in St. Louis in 1876, when an obliging policeman had helped him through a window. He'd gone to Illinois College and then to Union College of Law in Chicago. He made a particular study of oratory, at which he trained for years. Still, when he asked his mother's opinion of his first political speech in 1880, she said, "Well, there were a few good places in it, where you might have stopped." Moving to Nebraska, he'd settled in Lincoln, a prairie town, and the Union's fastest-growing state. He was elected to Congress as a Democrat in 1890 when he was 30. Boy Bryan, he was called. He began his first run for the presidency when he was 2 months shy of the required age. He would live his life on the political stage and die far diminished in the glow cast by the footlights. Nearly everyone who ever heard Boy Bryan said he was the best speaker they'd ever known. In an age before amplification, Bryan may have been the only speaker most people had ever really heard. He could project his voice for three blocks, and at events where speaker after speaker took to the stage, very often only Bryan's rose above the distant mumble of lesser men. He was also mesmerizing. The first presidential candidate to campaign on behalf of the poor, Bryan delivered the leveling promise of the Second Great Awakening to American party politics, and in the end, to the Democratic Party. One Republican said, "I felt that Bryan was the first politician I had ever heard speak the truth and nothing but the truth," even though in every case, when he read a transcript of the speech in the newspaper the next day, he disagreed with almost all of it. Lise didn't trust Bryan, mainly because she didn't trust anyone willing to join the Democratic Party, but also because she feared his lack of support for female suffrage. With Sarah Emery, Lise in 1891 signed the founding charter of the National Woman's Alliance, dedicated to uniting the causes of suffrage and populism. Its declaration of purposes called for the full political equality of the sexes. As the People's Party grew and began winning municipal and state elections, Lise and Emery and female suffrage remained at its center. Emery became editor of the party's magazine, New Forum. At the People's Party Convention in Omaha in 1892, Lise seconded the nomination of the party's presidential candidate, James Weaver. Her 12-year-old daughter, Evelyn Louise Lise, took the stage to call for a suffrage plank. "The motto of the alliance is equal right to all and special privileges to none," little Evelyn said. "But you are not true to that motto if you do not give woman her rights." But the People's Party betrayed Lise. The final platform, adopted on the 4th of July, included a preamble written by a Minnesota farmer named Ignatius Donnelly. "We meet in the middle of a nation brought to the verge of moral, political, and material ruin," Donnelly began. "Corruption dominates the ballot box, the legislatures, the Congress, and touches even the ermine of the bench." The platform called for the secret ballot, public ownership of the railroads, a graduated income tax, an 8-hour workday, and the direct election of U.S. senators, who were still being elected by state legislatures. Female suffrage was not among the party's demands. We seek to restore the government of the Republic to the hands of the plain people with whom it originated, Donnelly said. The plain people, the party's new leadership had determined, did not include women. Advocates argued that the party's best chances of success lay in fusing with the Democratic Party. Lise, opposed to fusion because she hated Democrats, grew disillusioned with the populist revolt after the Kansas People's Party merged into the Democratic Party in 1892. The next year, she was urged to run for the U.S. Senate. "No one can come between me and the people of Kansas," she said, "and if I want to be United States Senator, they will give me the office." She also considered running for Congress in Kansas's 7th District, but both times she decided against running, citing her worsening health. Calls for fusion only grew louder after 1893, when the nation fell once again into an economic depression triggered by the bankruptcy of the Philadelphia and Reading Railroad. Within months, more than 8,000 businesses, 156 railroads, and 400 banks had collapsed. 1 in 5 Americans lost their jobs. "I take my pen in hand to let you know that we are starving to death," a young woman farmer from Kansas wrote to her governor. But the hard times also narrowed the agenda of the People's Party, which focused on the fight for free silver, expanding the money supply by making silver, along with gold, the basis of currency. By now, Lise was leaning towards socialism. "Nationalize the railroads, telegraph, and all labor-saving machinery," she said in 1893, "to end the causes of industrial strikes and business disquietude." The suffering that followed the Panic of 1893 strengthened the income tax argument in Congress, where Bryan became its fiercest supporter. The time for an income tax seemed ripe. In the decades after the Civil War, the same labor-saving machinery that both created American prosperity and left many Americans behind in the new economy also advanced political debate about the distribution of wealth. The speed of transportation across the continent by railroad and across the oceans by steam meant the United States was fully immersed in a global traffic of goods and labor, while new technologies of communications, especially the telephone and the transatlantic telegraph, raised new challenges to long-standing convictions about tariffs and taxes. By now, income taxes had become commonplace in Europe. Responding to the suggestion that if Congress passed an income tax, rich Americans would flee to Europe, Bryan wondered where they would possibly go. "In London, they will find a tax of more than 2% assessed upon incomes," he said. "If they look for a place of refuge in Prussia, they will find an income tax of 4%. In 1894, Bryan tacked an income tax amendment to a tariff bill, which managed to pass. But the populist victory, a 2% federal income tax that applied only to Americans who earned more than $4,000, didn't last long. The next year, in Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust Company, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that the tax was a direct tax and therefore unconstitutional, one justice calling the tax the first campaign in a war of the poor against the rich. Populism entered American politics at the end of the 19th century, and it never left. It pitted the people, meaning everyone but the rich, against corporations, which fought back in the courts by defining themselves as persons. And it pitted the people, meaning white people, against non-white people who were fighting for citizenship and whose ability to fight back in the courts was far more limited, since those fights require well-paid lawyers. Populism also pitted the people against the state. During populism's first rise, the state as a political entity became an object of formal academic study through political science, one of a new breed of academic fields known as the social sciences. Before the Civil War, most American colleges were evangelical, college presidents were ministers, and every branch of scholarship was guided by religion. After 1859 and the Origin of Species, the rise of Darwinism contributed to the secularization of the university, as did the influence of the German educational model, in which universities were divided into disciplines and departments, each with a claim to secular and especially scientific expertise. These social sciences, political science, economics, sociology, and anthropology, used the methods of science, and especially of quantification, to study history, government, the economy, society, and culture. Columbia University opened a school of political science in 1880. The University of Michigan in 1881, Johns Hopkins in 1882. Woodrow Wilson completed a PhD in political science at Johns Hopkins in 1886. He planned to write a history of government and all the civilized states in the world to be called The Philosophy of Politics. In 1889, he published a preliminary study called simply The State. For Wilson's generation of political scientists, the study of the state replaced the study of the people. The erection of the state became, in their view, the greatest achievement of civilization. The state also provided a bulwark against populism. In the first decades of the 20th century, populism would yield to progressivism as urban reformers applied the new social sciences to the study of political problems, to be remedied by the intervention of the state. The rise of populism and the social sciences reshaped, too, the press. In the 1790s, the weekly partisan newspaper produced the two-party system. The penny press of the 1830s produced the popular politics of Jacksonian democracy,